London Business School's Reunion for New Alumni brings together the school's most recent alumni to reconnect with classmates and be inspired by expert faculty. The 2019 event featured a session on growing a business and life as an entrepreneur. It was led by Keith Willey, Adjunct Associate Professor of Strategy and Entrepreneurship. On the panel were LBS alumni and successful entrepreneurs Tara Reddy, CEO and co-founder of Loveshark, Estelle Lloyd, co-founder of Azumi, and Victor Steckley, CEO and co-founder of SportsCred.
Welcome, welcome. I recognise some of you having been my students. Some of you didn't have the joy of that experience, but now you do. So let me just introduce myself. I'm Keith Willey. I'm entrepreneurship faculty here, and I've been teaching here longer than this furniture has been here. How about that? Some people say I've been here as long as the furniture. I've been here longer. So I have a set of panelists here I'm going to introduce to you. We're taking time away from their businesses to share their experiences. I just thought we maybe ought to find out who's in the audience here in terms of, for example, put your hand up if you're running your own business now. Ah, a lot of you, okay. So it's a little late to be giving you advice now. Of the remaining, who is thinking they'd like to run their business? Okay, and that seems to overlap with the people that are in a business, so maybe you're thinking, it's not going to be this one, it's the next one, right? And then have we got people who invest in early stage businesses? Let's find, oh, here we are, these are the people we've really come to meet. very good. Okay, so I have for your delectation here, I have Victor, Estelle and Tara. So, as the ladies outnumber the men, we should let the men go first. Victor, tell us a little bit about your business, how you came to entrepreneurship and what your business is right now.
I come from a family business background, and that meant, in a way, that from the kind of family environment, it was always about my father working like hell. And at some point, he didn't want to work like hell, and his story was that actually he went and tried to find a job, but no one wanted to employ him. And so he had to carry on doing what he was doing, working for himself and growing the company. So that was kind of always back in mind about not necessarily not wanting to work for someone else, but just naturally just kind of doing work, whatever needed to be done, just kind of got done. Yeah. And then after graduating here, and I'd done a elective called Managing Sports and Entertainment Businesses, I was just astounded by the opportunities that exist within that sector. And I do a lot of sport myself. And so I kind of was looking for something and met someone else who was also on the same elective as I was, and we had a kind of business idea. And the business idea was around actually helping sports athletes, who are not necessarily celebrity athletes, get sponsorship for their social media. Their social media has an audience, and that audience is valuable to advertisers. So how do we connect then those people who may only have a few thousand followers on different social media channels, but how do we connect that? And so if you go and do anything at LBS and do anything that's entrepreneurial at all, they'll say, do you need something that's scalable? And probably something that's associated with the kind of the new technologies about internet, et cetera, and those opportunities the internet provides. So we managed to then build something that was about connecting brands or marketing agencies together with sports athletes to get sponsorship for their social media so that brands can reach their audience, okay? So it's all about the audience that these people have on those different social media channels.
Yeah. Victor, can I just follow up and say, did you start that straight out of business school? Is that the implication? Right, okay.
And so that was about 3.5 years ago that started. And at that time, it really wasn't a thing. I mean, we had this as an idea and we thought this could work. And we'd seen one or two sports people get some money for doing a tweet, some of that. So we thought there's something in there, right? But it really wasn't a thing. And so we spent an awful lot of time going and talking to people about it. And they said, well, maybe, maybe not. Sounds interesting, it's an idea. You've got to go and build something because otherwise no one really understands what you're talking about. And even when you build something, you then associate in a particular case with a double-sided market. You need sports talent and you need brands. And that's the starting off point, that you might have built something that's amazing and functionally brilliant, but you haven't got anyone using it. And I'm sure it's the same problem that eBay had and Airbnb had, et cetera, right? So that was then the first challenge. So that's what our business is about. And today we are in a few different countries around the world, et cetera.
Estelle, did you start from business school or?
I did. Ah. Yes, I did. My first company was actually a business school project. In my the entrepreneurship course that I took. I did the MBA Global. So I was dividing my time between New York, Colombia, and here, LBS, which was really fun, lots of traveling. And I had done about 10 years of investment banking before that in media and telecom and entertainment. So there I was. It was really a gift to myself, actually, to do the MBA. I was at a time in my career when I wanted to really consider being an entrepreneur. Actually, at the time, I really didn't know what I wanted to do next. I knew I was uncertain. I wanted to continue working in investment banking for lots of different reasons. And yes, I was sort of exploring the next stage in my career and took this amazing course and started working on this project. And then it really sort of came together during that time that that's what I was meant to do. I was meant to be running my own business. So it was really inspiring, really fun. And then coming here and taking courses here, which were different courses to the ones that I took in New York, very complimentary. I ended up moving here to London at about the same time. And then I started my first company in digital publishing in 2006, the year I graduated, and sold it to a FTSE 250 company called Centaur Media PLC in 2011, and then started another one, which is my current business, is called Azumi. Azumi is a multimedia platform, so games and video, for kids aged 5 to 10. We solve a very big pain point of parents, which is what are our children doing online and how can we give them a positive experience that really harnesses the power of technology to learn in a fun way. And for kids, we give them a really fun product and they're learning, but they don't really notice that they are learning. So it's a win-win for everyone. We've been going for 5 years. We've raised about £6 million. We are on a global rollout. The app is available in about 110 countries at the moment. So yeah, it's been another very exciting journey doing it again, so.
Very good, very interesting. Tara, tell us about your background and the run up to your business.
So I actually started out as a veterinarian and I was a vet for 6 years. And I think I was quite a good vet, but I was also a bit of a pain. In the veterinary industry, you're expected to toe the line. And I always wanted to innovate and be creative. So I think my bosses liked me, but found me a bit annoying. And eventually, I founded a vet business. I ran that for 2 years. And I really wanted to do something that was even bigger than that. But I didn't really know what my options were. So I came to LBS, did my MBA here. I graduated 2016. And in that time, I worked at multiple tech startups, just working out how it was in tech and where I would fit. And after I graduated, I went to work at Blipper, which is one of the leading augmented reality companies in the world. They are one of the global pioneers of AR tech. And when I was at Blipper, I saw this huge opportunity in augmented reality games. So I thought, let's do it. So I left my job there after 2 years and founded Love Shark. So Love Shark is my company, and we make social augmented reality games for mobile. So these are games that basically, we call them camera games. They basically put you in the game. So it's not an avatar, it's not a 3D model of you, it's you in the camera feed playing a game in real time. And you can play it on a mobile phone. So there's over a billion compatible devices in people's pockets right now, and that's going to triple over the next 3 years. So it's a huge opportunity. And yeah, so right now we're building, basically it's like the next generation gaming platform for Gen Z. So it's really for teenagers, and they can play games there, they can create videos, and they can and share them with the community.
Very good. So how about that? We've actually got a breadth of experience of people on the journey. Some Tara at the beginning, Estelle further along, second time around, Victor somewhere in between, I would say. I wanted to go back to one of the first things you said, Victor. I mean, one of the things we talk about a lot here in the faculty is the importance of role models. This has always been an important thing in entrepreneurship education because, you know, everyone else is going to go get a job. So where's your role model that you can kind of latch onto? Victor, you obviously had your father. I don't know whether that you there were other role models. I don't know whether you were kind of following Bill Gates or something. But maybe we've heard about your role model. Ladies, what did you have role models? Or did you have people that you felt you were copying somehow or taking advice from? Or
I wouldn't say I had one role model. I've always been interested in meeting entrepreneurs, and really, it's amazing just being here and listening to what you're saying, Victor, how similar it is in terms of, I think there is a certain way that the entrepreneurial mind works, and I think we all recognize each other when we meet each other. So, I mean, as far as I can remember, I was always thinking about how to build things differently, how something could be done differently, how I remember going shopping with my mom at a supermarket when I probably was about 13 years old and thought, why do we have to queue at the till? And there should be a way where you can put your trolley in a scanner and then it counts everything and gives you your bill and then you're out in a second, right?
Yeah. It's quite a strange memory. Still to be done.
But now it is done. It's done virtually. It's done on online. So, yes.
So you're kind of more opportunity scanning rather than
that's right.
trying to emulate somebody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I've always loved reading about stories of people that transform, that disrupt existing businesses or the way things are done. I've always, as far as I can remember, I've always been fascinated by that.
Right. Now, Tara, you took some of the entrepreneurship electives, didn't you? And then you went and got a job. So it's not a failure, that's okay. Otherwise, we'll have an empty class. You know, were you always harbouring a desire to start a business? And did you have a role model in mind?
Yeah, I mean, when I was growing up, I never thought, oh, I'm going to be a CEO and I'm going to be the big boss. It was never like that was not a particular aspiration. But I loved being creative and I loved finding solutions for problems. And then I think when I was a vet, I sort of got my first taste of that because I saw a problem, which was there was a niche market, which is exotic pets, so like birds, reptiles, etc., that wasn't being properly serviced. So I was in New Zealand. I was in the capital, Wellington. There was no vet looking after this type of creature. And I thought it was really unethical and it really bugged me. So I just said, okay, I'm going to start a business doing this. So I just did it. And that actually did really well. And when I left, I actually exited that business and another clinic took it on. And they said it's been one of the most successful parts of their business.
Wow, so that's a niche.
Yeah, exactly. It's niche, but actually people think like, oh, you pay like £20 for a hamster or a rabbit, you know, who's going to pay for healthcare for them? But actually, I charge twice as much for them as I did for a cat or a dog because it was a specialist service and people pay it. They love their pets.
Right. The sicker the pet, the more they'll pay. The more they feel the love. Yeah, so what about this journey? I do talk to students who are very afraid of passing up the offer from McKinsey or somebody and taking the entrepreneurial route. I mean, I'm sure, obviously, you all have your dark moments, but do you have any regrets about career? I mean, still, you were in investment banking, right? So you could just watch the bonuses roll in.
Well, or not, it depends. I do reflect back. Yes, I do reflect back on my career in investment banking. I do think that there comes a time, and I think when I was... So I was in investment banking from my mid-20s to my mid-30s. And I think it suited me well, but there was always this urge to do something else. And I actually was, bizarrely, and that was one of the first signs that I was ready to make the jump, is I was, even when I was in investment banking, helping entrepreneurs do their financial projections. So I was doing that pro bono. I had a lot of friends at the time. It was 99, 2000 in New York. It was right in the dot-com bubble, and a lot of my friends, a lot of people that I knew were starting businesses, so there I was essentially crunching numbers for them so that they could go and present to investors, and I just loved doing that. It was
Am I right in thinking that you've quite a big network in the entrepreneurial community? It sounds like you...
So, yes, I mean, yes, I suppose that after a while, it sort of moves in cohorts. Mm. So I'm part of a cohort of entrepreneurs. We've been part of similar programs. There are lots of programs in London. I've been part of the London Mayor's program, and then I joined the Upscale program. So it's an opportunity to meet and form a group of friends and entrepreneurs.
I met somebody on Thursday who had been on an entrepreneurial journey and now is part of a big company. And she said to me she'd like to get back into it, but she didn't know anybody because she's... Some of you working for big companies, you know, you're not allowed out of the office, basically, are you? You're not allowed to go and talk to people. You just have to do the work. And I was encouraging her to build a network, but it sounds like you naturally had it.
Yeah, I mean, networking, we all know it, whether you're in an entrepreneur or in a different profession, you have to invest in it. It doesn't happen. I mean, LinkedIn only goes so far. It's actually, I mean, I'd love to hear, you know, what you guys think, but it's actually very difficult to do when you're running a business. You really have to dedicate a specific amount of time to just doing that. And you don't really know, it's a bit of a risk because you don't really, you go to an event, you don't really know who you're going to meet, whether it's going to be useful or not, but you have to do it. You know that. So
you have to have faith in it. Victor, you skipped over jobs before the MBA. Were you a corporate person or were you...?
So my father had a family business, or we had a family business, and he died in 1998, and I was 31 at the time, and I took over then the leadership of that company at the time, and I did that for about 15 years, and we grew from being 10 kind of entities to 40 entities globally and, you know, whatever kind of doublings and triplings and quadruplings of different sales and monies and stuff, etc. And I stopped doing that when I could do it with my eyes closed. I could do it with, you know, both my hands tied behind my back. I was repeating myself. It was really successful. I mean, it was super successful. But I got so bored of just repeating myself with the same dialogue. I had the same problems, issues, whether it was in India or Brazil or Japan, whatever it was. And it just, I got bored of my own way of being ultimately. Yeah.
Yes.
Which is why I kind of stopped doing that and came and did an MBA, an executive MBA.
So I can see you and Estelle were both kind of talking about phases of your life where the next phase has to be the entrepreneurial one after doing something before. Tara, you were in Blipper, which had a lot of funding before it finally went. Was it 100 million or something, or 70 million?
No, it was over 100 million.
Over 100 million.
Maybe 150.
Yeah, and ultimately that didn't work. I mean, after you left...
Exactly.
It went bust. There may be a correlation. But did that make you sort of hesitate and say, hang on a minute, you know?
Not really. I mean, I think, like, working in a fast-growing company is, like, really good training for entrepreneurism because you just have to be really autonomous and basically the opportunity is there if you want to go out and do some big new initiative, you just can do it. So I think Blipper was really good training for that. And, no, I think... I always knew the risk was there. And I think there is a thing in entrepreneurs, like some switch in your brain where you kind of rationally know the risk is there, but you just put it away and just get on with it. So, yeah, it doesn't really bother me that much, to be honest.
Reckless would be another word, right? Maybe. Yeah. And so you're all at different stages. What do you think the kind of the big issues that keep you awake at night are now? What worries you about your business? Is it selling? Is it...
I mean, it's interesting. I was reflecting and I've been actually, I've had a lot of conversations recently with entrepreneurs around the concept of the mental charge, which essentially is that to-do list that never goes away. It is something that I suppose personally I wasn't completely aware of before I started my own business, and I've sort of gotten used to it, the fact that it's always with you, that you think about it, but not necessarily in a worried way or in a negative way. Most of the time, actually, it's in an exciting way. But it is always with you. It never, ever leaves you. From the minute you wake up in the morning, while you're doing something, while you're talking to someone, you're always thinking, oh, I didn't thought about this, and I haven't heard back from this person, or I completely forgot to reply to this email, or I need to put the strategy in place for this and that. And I suppose it's not for everyone. I do think that it takes a certain mind to be willing and to be enjoying that, actually, not just be willing to do it, but just to enjoy it and always, always find something positive in that state of mind is not a given.
You haven't got a big worry.
I do have lots of big worries. There are some big systemic changes, I think, in lots of different parts of the world and the economy that worry me, but both socially and also for my business. In particular, when it comes to children's education, technology and education, and access to social media and certain games and online for children, there is a big worry there in terms of where is the world going? Is there going to be some regulation? And if it happens eventually, what impact is it going to have? So that is, it's not so much of a worry, it's more of a, it's something that is definitely front of mind.
Yeah.
For sure.
And Victor, what's worrying you? You talked earlier about having to get this kind of two-sided thing moving, isn't it? Is it the speed of development that's worrying you?
It's definitely... I think the biggest worry you have is always fear of failure, right? And I remember one of the professors here saying, what's the difference between, you know, a good entrepreneur and a stupid entrepreneur somehow? And the, you know, definition was, well, the whoever's successful or not, right? And so you kind of go away going, I really don't want to be in that category of being the stupid entrepreneur, right? So the fear of failure is really omnipresent, especially at first, right? And then once you actually have a thing and it actually starts having its own life and it doesn't depend upon only you going and doing something, then your worry is about the other people that are doing much more of what you're doing, whether they're the right people for you. I have a particular instance with someone in the team who I don't think is the right person, but it's not that you also have about, you know, so many people that you can just somehow manage one out and then have another one come in. Everyone is so important. So it's kind of one of the key worries. And speed of development, because we're in a technology sector and we do have competitors. And so kind of keeping an eye upon what they're doing and making sure that we are going to be expanding as fast as possible globally. We've got an IT infrastructure, we've got a product which is online. So that can work globally. So how can we get this thing out, you know, as fast as we can globally? That's my other kind of worry. And then that links the people you can find in those different locations.
Right. And Tara, you're just getting off the ground. What's bothering you at the moment? Just raising some money?
Yeah, I mean, raising money is always a bit of a roller coaster, but I think I try to just step back and remind myself that it's a roller coaster for everyone, and some days it's like a bit stressful and some days it's great. But I think like the real thing that worries me is just the speed that information moves on the internet, and when you start to build a content platform, which is what we're building, you hope that people will use it in the right way, and you don't always have a lot of control over how they use it. So things like YouTube obviously is like a great innovation, but also it's had some bad times as well. So I think, yeah, like I always try to really like build our products with like good ethics from the ground up, but sometimes you're like, what if I didn't make the right choice and something happens and it's, you know, it affects someone badly. So like those are the things that keep me up at night.
Interesting. And so actually you've sort of a high degree of congruence between you there, that they're kind of strategic things rather than next week's crisis or whatever. What about this team thing? What have you learned about teams? Have you found the best place to find good people, or how to manage them? Because that becomes a problem later on, right?
Yeah, I mean, my biggest learning, and it's actually surprisingly, given that we've been going for 4 years, it's surprising that it took us this long to get to that learning. And when I say we, it's the management team, it's four of us at management level, is the fact that we didn't have clear objectives for the team. So we've moved to an OKR organization now. It's taken us 4 years. It's incredible. When I really mean it, that for all this time, we didn't have not so much a very structured OKR framework, but a new, very clear objectives to the team. And if you don't set objectives, it's very difficult to then go to somebody and say you're not doing a good job, because, you know, you haven't really explained what your benchmark of a good job is going to be. So it's really, really unfair. So we ended up in circular conversations around what the expectations were, both from our side, but also from the side of the employee. And I'm very happy that we are now fully functioning in this OKR framework. It's a hell of a lot of work. It really forces you to have a very rigorous, you know, work ethic around that framework. You really cannot miss any. You have to constantly go and input more information into the objectives and constantly do some check and balances. But I really think that works really well for us at the size where we are. We're 25 people right now in the company, and we're probably at the lower end of what's recommended to implement in a company-wide OKR framework, but I'm really pleased we've done that, for sure.
All right. Victor, your problem person, was it a bad hire, or did you outgrow them, or is it behavioural?
When you're starting something, you don't actually know exactly what profile of person you may need. And so, unless you've got really specific expertise in a certain area, so you're going to hire other people who may have better expertise, that, you know, the person individually is very expertise in kind of media market in the European country. I thought that profile was right. I look back now, I think I wouldn't hire someone of that profile again. What our business needs right now for that location is something else, right? At the time, someone comes along, they're enthusiastic, you know, you're not in the activity in that area. And it depends who comes through the door when you're starting, because you haven't really got anything to attract people. So whoever comes along goes, yeah, I quite like the look of what you're doing. You go, well, okay, seems reasonable. Let's do something together. I mean, you know, you've got enthusiasm, I've got enthusiasm. I mean, we're going to get a long way with that, yeah? And then later on, your business kind of evolves a little bit and you realise you're not quite the right person, actually, after all. Sorry about that. And that's quite tough because you do invest a lot emotionally, certainly at the early stages with people, because you expect them to be doing a lot for, you know, the business somehow, based upon a lot of goodwill and a lot of, like, future, it's going to be, you know, really great, but right now, sorry, you're going to have to walk to the meeting. You know, you can't go by bus, you know. I exaggerate, obviously, just in case you got worried there. So that's hard. I mean, those things. Yeah. Those things are sort of hard. They keep you awake at night because it's this relationship thing that I've got a relationship with someone and I hold that quite dearly and I like to keep to what we've agreed, but I don't know if I can because it's not quite working out.
Mm. Right. And do you have, like, a partner or somebody who works for you who you can discuss those things with about the people?
Personally, me?
Yeah.
Not really, no.
So you're still a kind of... Yeah. You have to be the daddy to the situation.
Mm.
Or the mummy.
Definitely. Oh, I'm definitely not the mummy. I've got three children already. I'm not the mummy.
It's just a seamless...
But I do agree with you. The firing is dreadful. It really is. And when you know you have to do it, delaying it, it's a feeling before it becomes a reality. It's very difficult to explain.
Absolutely.
But and that time lapse between when you get the feeling and when it becomes a reality can be quite long and it's miserable. And it is dreadful. It is one of the hardest things, really, and sometimes heartbreaking. But when you know you have to do it, I mean, you have a duty to look after the rest of the business, the rest of the company, and that's what you have to come back to. But, yeah.
It's probably what Tara has gone through, being a vet, in reality.
This thing is going to be put down.
This is going to be put down.
Oh, God.
Thankfully, Tara, that hasn't happened yet, has it? You're busy gathering people,
yeah, exactly.
Happy people.
Yeah.
Right.
It's been like, I mean, I think we're just so early. There's like five of us right now. So the hiring's actually been okay because it's mainly come from our network. But now as we want to get more talent, I'm noticing it's really, really hard because I think it was just a given that the people that we hired initially, they shared the same values as us. They had an interest in what we're doing and a passion for it. And we knew them well. So we kind of knew what kind of people they are. And now when it comes to like hiring external people that you've not met before, I found that really hard to even find those good people and find people that have the right values. So I would say like that's probably our like biggest challenge right now. And things like Brexit I don't think is helping because the European engineers are not as quick to come over and work here now. There's a bit of more sluggishness there. But yeah, luckily I haven't got to this point yet. But
yeah. So have any of you got somebody you can talk these things over with? Even outside the business, do you have like board directors or investors who can give you a push to, you know, grip up a human resource issue? Or
personally, I don't, which maybe is, I don't know if it's the right or wrong thing, but even before my previous job when I was running this other family business, etc., I didn't really have anyone at that time either. I kind of managed to sort it out, you know, overall. So I kind of probably have a lot of experience of dealing with situations, working it through, etc.
What about the ladies? Do you have a sort of confidant on these things that are difficult?
My board is very helpful. They challenge us in the right way. So, yes, they've been very supportive. And we've had some very open conversations, particularly on hiring and, you know, as I was saying, letting go of people. Yes, it's been a very healthy, very good relationship. Ultimately, at the end of the day, you sort of have to make the decision yourself, but it is useful to have that sounding board for sure. Mm-hmm. One thing I wanted to add to what we were saying previously is that the competition for talent, in fact, the competition for everything as an entrepreneur is much higher than it was 10 years ago. When I started my first business 10 years ago, I don't have any evidence, but I felt that there was less competition for talent, competition for funding. Mm. I see a lot of people coming out of the finance industry, for example, who are looking to start their own businesses, and they come with a huge network already. They really know how to manage the spreadsheets, and they are, you know, brutally competitive. So It's, you know, talent, funding, even finding board members. Everyone is sort of looking at what the best option is. It's
interesting. Yeah. So, Tara, who's going to be your guru on people matters?
So, well, first of all, I have a co-founder, which is like just fantastic because he's someone that I've worked with for several years. So we have a very good relationship, and I can talk to him about any problems, any worries in the business. And we appointed a board member earlier this year who's someone that's been in the game industry for 20 years. And obviously he has great experience, but he's also just a very nice, experienced, approachable, well-networked person. So actually for anything like that, I can go to him and he usually has like a lot of good solutions and advice. So I feel actually quite well supported in what I'm doing.
Very good, very good. Okay, now, folks, we are coming up against 5:30, which I think is when we're supposed to finish. But I did ask our panellists to leave us with one thought each, okay? They don't have to answer me. They can say what the hell they like. But I thought a good thing to hear from them would be the biggest reason why you would recommend the entrepreneurial career route to an LBS MBA, knowing that half the room are thinking about it. What is your biggest reason why somebody else should do it?
I guess it's really, I think, really simple. If you have something that you think you want to go and do, and you then end up, you know, another decade goes by, et cetera, and it's all kind of, everything's going south, yeah, then you're going to regret it. You're going to have that regret that you may have actually wanted to go and do something. So, you know, in a way, just to avoid that regret that you may have, I can't recommend it enough.
FOMO, fear of missing out.
Personal fear of missing out, yeah. Right. It's a chance for you to use all your skills and find out about yourself. Yeah, you'll never know more about yourself than doing that, right? That's exciting. Yeah, that's really exciting. It's a very adventurous life.
Okay, Estelle?
Yeah, I think mine is a bit more practical in the sense that I'm mentoring a few startups, and I see that where they struggle the most is on the finance part, when they have to explain their financial projections, when they have to look at do things like budgeting. And I think that as an LBS alumni, you have that strong foundation. You really know how to do that very well. That gives you a massive competitive advantage to a lot of companies out there looking for funding. And if you don't raise funding, or if you're not lucky enough to be able to self-fund your business, either because you have the money to do that or because your business doesn't need a lot of funding to begin with, then unfortunately you're competing against a lot of people that are coming from the financial world that decided to become entrepreneurs because they prefer to do that rather than being relocated to Amsterdam right now. And that's very competitive. And having that strong foundation of putting together a very, very strong plan for what your business is going to, particularly around finance, gives you a massive advantage. So you should definitely use it.
Wow, thank heaven for business skills. Mm. Well, we managed to teach people something. Tara?
Yeah, I think, like, you're never going to know unless you actually have a go. So I would say it's always better to fail and learn than to not try. And I think the MBA just gives you an amazing toolkit. It really, for me, it really set me up to just understand all parts of the business so I could be bad at a lot of things instead of being awful at all of them. So, and I think the other thing is the network is amazing. Like, LBS Network has helped me so much through finding investors, mentors, etc. So, like, really take advantage of that. Like, it's, you're really lucky to have this network, and just do it before you get too comfy with a good pay packet.
Yeah. That's a brilliant note to end on. Folks, I think we should thank our panellists for coming in.
This podcast was brought to you by London Business School, bringing you thought leadership from London Business School's global experts. For more insight and expert opinion, go to london.edu/LBSR.